Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Chaim Schmidt from the Kosher Scene. Our guest this evening, who should be calling in momentarily, is Gabriel Sanders. Gabriel Sanders has been at the helm of publicity for Susie Fishbein's 8-volume Kosher by Design series since the first book appeared in 2003. Among other projects, he's handled on behalf of publisher R. Scroll Mesorah Publications are Life is a Test by Rebbetzin Esther Jungreis, Gateway to Judaism by Rabbi Mordechai Becher, and several books by Rabbi Dr. Avraham Tversky and Rabbi Pesach Kron. Sanders' voice is familiar to many Jewish radio listeners in the New York area, appearing in over 100 commercials. He has also produced and hosted Manishma with Gabriel on FiveTownsRadio.com, IsraelNationalRadio.com, The Jewish Journey on JewishWisdom.com, and The Gabriel Sanders Show on Zev Brenner's Talkline Communication Network. He recently began broadcasting on J-Root Radio. Sanders has lectured from coast to coast and internationally on themes of Jewish living, including his popular autobiographical presentation of A Minister's Journey to Judaism. This should prove to be a fascinating show, if he calls in, that is. I guess we will have to reschedule for within 15 minutes, and we'll come back to you. Let's log out for now. Good evening, Gabriel. Good evening, Gabriel.
Chaim.
Good evening, Gabriel. Can you hear me?
Yes, I was muted for some reason. Don't know why.
Yeah, I apologize for that, but there was a technical problem. We finally solved it. Well, one thing has me puzzled. Tell me, what in your life prompted a good, sincere Christian to become a truly Orthodox Jew? What event in your life suddenly made you change your whole plan, everything that you thought you were going to do?
Well, I'll get to that in a moment. First of all, let me just do a little sound check. Are you hearing me okay? The volume's all right?
The volume is okay.
Excellent. So the answer to that question is really, my favorite answer to that question is cholent. Because the answer is a challenge. People think that it was something episodic, cataclysmic, something titanic in nature, when really it was, you know, a challenge is, as you well know from the world of cooking, is something that consists of ordinary ingredients that over time creates a gastronomically wonderful, extraordinary taste result, especially if you have good guests for Shabbat, you know.
So, absolutely.
My answer to that, the most succinct answer, is a challenge. It's a good metaphor. It's a good good mashal, because it was, you know, in the world that I come from, conversions are episodic, immediate. They're usually something of an upheaval nature in a person's life. They were at a low point, and somebody talked to them, or they prayed, or they had some kind of spiritual experience which seemed to turn a light on for them. So it was an immediate darkness to light kind of transition. And coming to Judaism is not like that. At least for most people that I know, and I know many other gerim like myself, I know there's a growing number that come from a very devout, I kind of, for the sake of the Jews listening, I like to use the phrase, I was a Haredi Christian, okay, so they seem to they resonate with that. Just to let you know the degree of intensity and focus and commitment and devotion that I had, it wasn't, I wasn't a liberal Christian, I wasn't a cultural Christian. I grew up with a little Catholic environment, and that was enough to teach me that God had a last name. I remember those nuns that I had in the first and second grade, and it was a terrifying experience because, as they said, from them I learned that God's last name was, well, his first name was God, and his last name was Zilla, that he was fire-breathing and angry and retributive, and everyone was hell-bound, and there were all these lists of, you know, he was sort of like an angry Santa Claus making a list and checking it twice, and he knew I was naughty and not nice. It was a it was a tough row to hoe, so to speak. I mean, he was a little kid bearing all the guilt of the world on his shoulders. Fortunately, my mother she left the Catholic Church, and we were essentially goyim for nothing. You know, I was a goy for nothing until I was about 16. Someone introduced me to Christianity, and that began a whole new chapter. Along the way, there were some other exposures to Judaism that might be worth talking about. But the answer to your question succinctly is it's a challenge. So it's a process answer, not a point in time answer.
Okay. Now, if it was challenge, what other Jewish delicacies entered your life at some point that convinced you that maybe you should try Judaism, at least for the food?
Well, I've always had an affinity for Jewish food, although I must say that my first exposure to Jews of any kind was in Florida when I was in the sixth grade, and I had a Jewish friend named Marty Shapiro. He had a brother named Harvey. I always mention their names in the faint hope that maybe I'll find them somewhere and I can thank them for something they didn't know they had a role in. So I went to their home one day, and it was the first time I'd ever stepped into a Jewish home, and the assault on my nose was pretty strong. It was the smell of cooked cabbage. I never smelled cooked cabbage in my life. You know, I don't know what they were making, but it was. And then I heard this very grating voice, which I later understood was a Brooklyn accent. I'd never heard a Brooklyn accent. And she was yelling at her youngest son, saying, "Javi, go study a Hebrew." I had no idea what a Hebrew was either, and why anybody would want to study it was beyond me. You know, so but that was my very first exposure. Much later, like let's fast forward. That was sixth grade. So if we fast forward 12 years to when I was about 24, as a young missionary, having graduated from the Bible College in Los Angeles, I was serving my church as a covert missionary in the land of Israel. And a young lady, I joined an ulpan because it seemed very expedient to learn Hebrew. So getting out of a tractor wagon in Agala one morning about 5 in the melon fields of Kibbutz Ein Dor, and this young lady said to me, no idea who she is, where she went, what she did, but what she said had an indelible impression on my life. She said, you know, when you gain another language, you really gain another soul. And I have to attribute the birth of my, you know, my Jewish neshama, my Hebrew soul, to the acquisition of the Hebrew language. Again, it's a long tributary of thought in itself if we go down the theological corridor that I walked in order to come to Judaism. There were social reasons, there were theological reasons, there were cultural reasons. But again, a challah, a blended package. But for me, I my process of learning Hebrew in order to convince Jews that, that JC was the Messiah, and it kind of backfired on me over time. It took a long time. But the ultimate outcome of it was that I did, because of Hebrew, because of the glasses, the linguistic glasses that I gained through the Hebrew language, I realized that there were some very serious problems both with the Christian scriptures and with the Christian interpretation of the Jewish Bible, specifically many of the so-called messianic prophecies that were supposed to have been fulfilled in JC himself. And the more I learned Hebrew and the more I looked into the actual context of those, what we used to call proof texts, I realized, that they were spoof texts. You know, that they've been, there's a very famous Hasidic story that fits this very well. I think your listeners will appreciate it. Man is walking, it's from the Maggid of Midrash, by the way, just to attribute it. Man's walking through the woods and he sees an arrow shot in the middle of a bullseye on the side of a tree, and he goes and sees another arrow, another bullseye, another, you know, right in the center. He thinks to himself, there's a great archer, somebody here really knows how to shoot arrows. And he goes a little further, sees some more bullseyes, you know, centered with an arrow, and he meets a guy leaning against a tree, and he sees he has a bow and he has some arrows, and he said, did you shoot all those bullseyes? And the guy says, yeah, I did. You must be the greatest archer in the world. How did you do that? And he says, you want to see? And he says, yeah, I want to see. So he stands up, takes an arrow, puts it in the bow, shoots it, and then grabs a paint can and paints the bullseye. So what I was forced to deal with is that many of the so-called messianic or Christian prophecies about JC, the proof text, are really painted into, retrojected is the right term, they're retrojected or thrown back in after the fact. We even find sources in some of the early church fathers which admit that that's what they did, by the way, but that's a kind of suppressed element in theological circles. You know, here I am. I'm in Israel. I lived in Israel for 4 years as a young missionary, learning more and more Hebrew, trying to talk to Jews about JC, about their Messiah, and realizing there's a problem here, and the problem's with me, and it's with my belief system. I guess the last thing I could say about that before you go to the next question maybe is I had to ask myself I'll put it in very succinct terms. All these things that I learned in Bible college in my, from when I got a license and became an ordained minister, et cetera, all these things that I've been taught, do I believe it because it's true or is it true because I believe it? Those are two different, distinct...
Very different, absolutely.
Yeah, is it true because I believe it or do I believe it because it's true? If it's true because I believe it, what happens if I shift my belief? But if I believe it because it's true, it means I've done some homework. And my experience in the Christian world, for as I look back on it reflectively, and I was in the Christian world for over 20 years, so it was not a... I was not just staying in the Motel 6 of spirituality. I was there for a long time.
Right.
I worked in some very large churches. You know, the last church I worked in had over 12,000. Today it has 12,000 members. When I left, it had 10,000. It was a mega church, and I worked with some very well-known people in the world of Christianity, television, radio, publishing, etc., music. It was a mega church that had quite an impact on the world, and they are the ones that sent me to Israel, by the way. So it's a bit of a awkward situation that they sent me to win Jews to JC, and ultimately I came to see that Judaism is true, particularly the Torah is true. You know, there's a lot of different spins on what Judaism is, but let's just say Torah is true. If we go back to Har Sinai, to Mount Sinai, we find the truth there, the 3 million people plus that heard and saw and transmitted that to their generations and lived and died for that, the preservation of that truth, and to transmit that down to today. That's a big thing. Nobody else has that.
Well, put it this way, had it not been for your missionary work, you never would have become a Jew. So it's interesting that your path to Judaism was through Jesus.
So I owe him a debt of gratitude. People ask me periodically, do I have any regrets?
you know, how can you regret the path that you walked that brought you to a place that you didn't even know you could get to? So I have some regret over Jews that I brought to Christianity and my ignorance. Of course, we didn't call it Christianity. We called it Messianic Judaism. We called it Hebrew Christianity. We used different labels, but it really was the same garment.
That's right.
But, you know, I've reached out to some of those in the past. I mean, I was thinking about, in fact, in preparation for this program, I was thinking through people that I've had the opportunity to connect with, and there's one person I think of right now that was in the top leadership of a very well-known Messianic organization, and I worked with this person, you know, to remain nameless and genderless. I worked with this person for a year to help this individual come out. I learned a great deal about the inner workings of the organization through the process, and today that person is definitely out, very much a part of the Jewish community, doing some amazing work to make a difference in the world. I know a number of other former Messianic Jews, or Messianic Christians, if you will, Messianic Gentiles, who have also come to Torah Judaism because they walked a similar path. They loved God, they loved the Bible, they loved prayer, they were hungry for the truth. Oftentimes they began to dig further into the Hebrew language, and the language gave them help, or they spoke to someone who could explain to them the context of the verses that the Christians had co-opted, like Isaiah 7:14 on the virgin birth, or Isaiah 53 on the suffering servant, or Jeremiah chapter 31, 31 through 34 on the, what is the new covenant, the Brit HaChadashah, Genesis 3:15, the Protevangelicum, the forecasting of, quote, the virgin birth, which really isn't. For most Jews, I start quoting these passages, and it spins their heads because they don't learn the Bible this way. They say, well, what parsha is that, or what Haftarah is that? Is that even in our Bible? And so I came to Judaism, in fact, next month on the 23rd of Kislev, we're almost into Kislev now, on the 23rd of Kislev, I will turn 13 years old as a Jew. So it's my bar mitzvah year. Yeah, I'm very excited. But it took decades, really, to get here. And so I'm very grateful and very thankful. And now after 13 years, and certainly 10-plus years being married to a woman who's been Shomer Shabbat all her life, and we have a wonderful family together and an extended family and growing opportunities and the work that I've done, of course, with Art Scroll and with Susie Fishbein and many other people. I got tired listening to your introduction. When I listened to your introduction earlier on the show, I thought, I've done all that? No wonder I'm so tired. You know? But I look back over it all, I'm very, very thankful. Let me just give you one thing, I guess, I could say that's probably very helpful to a lot of people. People ask me, well, you know, what kind of Jew are you? In fact, I went to do a lecture one time in a city. It was very funny. And as I was setting up around my little area, a fellow came up to me and said, so you're the former minister who became a Jew, right? I said, yeah, that's what it says on the program, so I guess it's me. And he said, so you look kind of modern. Are you a Reformed Jew? I said, well, I used to be. My first conversion was actually a Reformed conversion. I was in that movement for 2.5 years, I guess, at least 2.5 years. I even was the Magid Shir. I led the Torah study on Shabbat morning, and led the tefillah, led the prayer service. But I said that I don't think Judaism needs to be reformed. It needs to be performed, because of Har Sinai, our people said, Naaseh v'nishma. So Judaism is very much about doing. Kabbalistically, we're in the world of Asiyah, the world of action. So Judaism is something we need to perform, not to reform. You said, well, now you sound kind of conservative. And I said, well, I understand what you mean by that. I've been in a number of conservative congregations. But we don't have to be conservative about Judaism. We can be very liberal about spreading its message. But we do have to keep it going from generation to generation. So you can say conservative. I'm going to say we need to be preservative about Judaism. And then he said to me, well, now you sound kind of orthodox. I said, that's funny you say that. The word orthodox means right thinking. But again, going back to this idea of orthopraxy or practice, you know, I see Judaism as straightening things out that have been out of shape. When we say in the Aleinu, "Letaken olam b'malchut shakai," to rectify the world under the sovereignty of God, That's like an orthopedic approach to things or an orthodontic approach. So I said to him, you can say reform, I'll say perform. You can say conservative, I'll say preservative. You can say orthodox, I'll say orthodontic or orthopedic. Because I don't like labels. I've had my Jewish journey. Chaim, you have your Jewish journey. Everyone lives has their own spiritual journey, Jewish or not. They have their own journey to the center of who they are. And that's the, we just read a couple of weeks ago in the Parsha study where God says to Abraham, to Abraham, our forefather, Lech Lecha. And one interpretation of the word Lech Lecha, which means go for yourself or go to yourself, means come to who you are. Find out who you are. And the Jewish journey has these milestones where you can truly connect with the essence of who you are. And I've been very helped along the way by such personalities, some of them you mentioned, like Rabbi Tzion Rice and Rabbi Pesach Kron, and Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman was a big help to me, and Rabbi David Aaron from the Israelite Institute, and Reb Volbe's Shlita Hazatzal, who was recently passed away a few years ago, from the Muslim movement, and other personalities that have been very key in the development of my inner life.
Bob, what's interesting is, and I gather this from your words and from reading into your words, what's interesting is that you don't count yourself as having arrived, okay, you at your destination. What I hear is you're still seeking, you're still trying to grow, you're still trying to understand. Basically, that's what a true Jew is supposed to do. Still trying to understand, still trying to grow, no matter how much he may have or she may have achieved. And that is very commendable. There is no question that even in your most Christian days, you still had nothing but a Jewish soul.
I've been told that, and I guess that's true. Obviously, I'm still here. People ask me when I do lectures, one of the most common questions that comes up is, well, you know, you were this and you became that and then you did this and you became that and you were in and you were out. And how do we know that this isn't just some phase in your life and you're not going to morph into something else, you know, out of Judaism and into something else? And so I can thank the Beit Din, the rabbinical court, and the rabbis that worked with me for a settled sense of permanency. Before we buy a pair of shoes or before we purchase a car, we try on the shoes and we test drive the car. And I took Judaism for a test drive for close to 2 years. Now, this is after a Reform conversion and being in the Reform movement, and then moving on to what's called a conversion, Gerut al pi halacha, you know, a conversion according to Jewish law. And that was very rigorous, and I had to demonstrate. You know, I couldn't get by on my intellect or my personality. I had to demonstrate that I actually knew what I was talking about. And that was a good thing for me, and the fact that it took a long time to do it was even better. Again, it gave the cholent a chance to really steep into to the flavors that sort of come together. And I'm thankful for that. They took more time with me than they might have with somebody else. Somebody else they might have done in a year. Me, they pushed closer to, by the time it was all done, it was closer to 2 years. And I'm thankful looking back. And during the time, I was miserable. I thought, come on, please. You know, I'd already had a bar mitzvah in the Reform movement, right? I was a Torah study. I'd lived in Israel for 4 years. I spoke Hebrew. I wanted some, like, extra credit or something, life experience credit, like they'll give you in college. But this wasn't that kind of college. So the fact that it was a rigorous process was good for me, and it cleared it out from being something that was purely emotional. It wasn't. It certainly wasn't just a psychological thing. I really wanted to serve. I'll say it very simply, and this bugs my former Christian friends a lot. I just really wanted to serve God better. I wanted to be able to love God better. I wanted to know what God wanted from me in a very tangible way. And Judaism spells it out very clearly. There's really no ambiguity, you know, and it gives that what I, one of the things I really love is that I know who I am. I know that I am a, I am an eternal soul in a temporary body. And I know that this body has its own appetite, and part of my life mission is to make this body a servant of the soul that I am. It's like a car, or I call it my animated mud pot, because it's made from the ground, just like the animals, but it's infused with the breath of God. You, I, everyone on the planet is infused with the breath of God. And finding out how that, to let that part of you have supremacy, to be in the driver's seat, so to speak, and not dominated by your passions, by the whimsical nature of one's emotions, is a very powerful thing. And Judaism has a technology, I would call it a spiritual or characterological technology, whereby an individual can access that, whether it's through aspects of Hasidut or whether it's through aspects of the Muslim movement in particular, that help a person to identify, quantify, and cultivate a very clear sense of values that are translated into thought and word and deed. That's Judaism.
You speak beautifully. There is no question, there is a tremendous amount of feeling, a tremendous amount of passion. But I am sure also that during your journey, there must have been some funny incidents, or at least incidents that on looking back are funny.
Yes.
Care to share some of them?
I'll tell you one of the first that comes to mind. And again, it takes having a little bit of, I suppose, orthodox literacy to appreciate the humor behind what I'm saying. But I, there was a particular rabbi that was on my rabbinical court, Rabbi Summers from Los Angeles, whom I dearly love, very close to him and his family. And I was living in Orange County, which is 50 miles to the south, and I would come up periodically to stay in the Pico Robertson area of Los Angeles, which is a largely Orthodox area. Because I was doing something I call Project In Your Face. So I'm going to be everywhere these members of my Beit Din are, they're going to see me. Here, there, everywhere, in this shiur, in that shiur. So I asked Rabbi Summers if I could be hosted someplace for a Shabbat dinner. He said, yeah, I got a good family for you. So I went to the dinner, but he didn't tell the host anything about me whatsoever. He said, I'm a guest for your table. So at the end of the dinner, it was my host. There was just the family was around. So there was a host and his oldest son, who was bar mitzvah, and me. And he looked at me and he said, would you like to leave the benching? And I looked down and I said, but I'm sitting on a chair. I had no idea. What he was talking about. And I said, and where do you want me to take the bench? You know, do you have a bench? You want me to lead it someplace? You know, so, you know, the learning that, you know, I mean, leading the benching is a Yiddish expression. You know? So
right.
I confess that it took me quite a while to become more bilingual. You know, I speak, I'm fluent in Hebrew, and I have a pretty good base of Arabic as well, and I'm not too bad at Spanish. I speak a little bit of English. So, but the humor along the way of these Yiddishes and these things that I didn't understand was pretty funny. I find, by the way, and this is true of many gerim, regardless of their level of their aptitude in Hebrew, you always feel like you're kind of huffing and puffing to catch up or to stay up with where everybody else seems to be. It seems like everybody else knows more than you do. Everybody else does it better than you do. Everybody else just can do it.
By the way, that is not just Gerim. As a matter of fact, a prominent rabbi, who shall remain nameless, except for the fact that I'm going to say he's somewhere in upstate New York, when he became a Baal Tshuva, he heard that Orthodox Jews, before davening at Shachris, they go to the mikveh. Okay, so first he had to find out what's a mikveh. Finally, he found out that in a particular city, there really was a mikveh. So he applied for membership so he could get a key. And he was told that, no, the only ones who can get a key are married women. He was furious. he went to a rabbi, he went to a lawyer who happened to be the president of one of the Orthodox shuls, and he wanted to sue the mikveh for gender discrimination. So finally the lawyer convinced him, no, no, you can't do that. So it's not only Gerim, but even people who were born Jewish, who unfortunately did not get the education they should have. Then mistakes like that happen, and believe me, if you see him now, you'd never believe that this guy could have been anything but ultra-religious from the very second he was born.
Hmm. Well, I understand that very, very well. I visit places that I have been along the way in my journey, and it's very interesting to go back and feel the same feelings that I had when, you know, there were things that I couldn't do. I remember during my Gerut process where I couldn't hold the Sefer Torah during Simchat Torah, and how devastated I felt inside, because even when I was a missionary in Israel, I went to a shul one night in Rosh Pina, and they gave us the Sefer Torah. Of course, they didn't ask me, you know, by the way, are you Jewish? They didn't ask that. We had a yarmulke, the guys I was with, so they said, okay, these are, you know, not such observant guys, but maybe something will happen in their lives if they dance with the Sefer Torah.
Right.
Little did they know.
Obviously, they were right. Obviously, they were right.
Yes, they were right. So there have been a lot of little funny events along the way, you know, from everything from brachas that messed up in the middle of saying them to mixing up holidays or dates or just there's so many details to master. But that's the beauty of it, is that the errors that one commits become stepping stones of learning and reference points of progress, which is a very exciting thing to me. So, you know, I truly feel 13, I guess, in my Jewish journey. I've been very blessed along the way to have a voice, both through the media and through lectures and through the work that I do with the largest Jewish publishing company, at least English language publishing company, Artsco. And mm-hmm. they've all been very patient with me. That's one of the things people ask me: have you ever felt sidelined, or has anybody ever sort of pushed you to the side because of the fact that you weren't born Jewish? That's a good question. My mother was adopted. Her birth name was Miller. That could go either way, so we don't really know. But the answer to that is no. I never once felt anything other than accepted and welcomed. I can't say that for everybody, by the way, but I certainly say
right.
that for myself.
That's true.
I definitely had that, so I'm very thankful. It opens up all kinds of interesting doors, like talking with you and your amazing audience right now.
Okay, so now let's talk a little bit, since you mentioned Art School, let's talk a little bit about some of the projects you've been involved with at Art School.
Well, of course, I began with Art School working on a very not so well-known project, but certainly it was a significant one, which was a textbook project called Text Word Press, which was a high school literature series, a four-year anthology for high school students. And they created a series that was classic literature, well-done pieces, mostly public domain pieces, in a very compelling pedagogical wrapper, I would say. I mean, good learning skills that taught students critical thinking, literary analysis. Anybody who went through that series would be sharp. And I was asked to see if we could push it beyond the Jewish world, and I did. I actually brought it to a major Christian publishing company in another state, and they adopted it as their own high school text and marketed it to their many of the schools that they had, over 1,000 high schools that they were connected to. So that's how I began. And from that, once I was inside, as that sort of found its own footing, I was asked to do other things. They discovered, for example, that I could write. That's very funny, by the way. You ask yes for things that are funny. I failed a couple of courses in college because I couldn't write. I could talk. I could stand up and speak extemporaneously about anything. You know, bumps on pickles, okay, dust under the bed. But to sit down and write something that was methodical and cogent and outlined, I couldn't do it. It took me many years to learn that. And today, Baruch Hashem, I'm a pretty good writer. To the extent that, you know, if you take a book from art school, not all the ones, but you know, there was a certain period where almost all the book, all the flap copies, you open it up and you read, well, what the book, this book about, and on the back, and about the author. I was the guy doing a lot of that writing, you know, the anonymous book flap author. And then I got involved with Susie Fishbein in her first book, which came out in March of 2003, the runaway best-selling cookbook with the funny name Kosher by Design. And I worked on each of Susie's books from the publicity side of things, like how do you create the message, the talking points about each of these unique, now 8 different cookbooks. So, and not only to get it to the general, you know, the core Jewish audience, the kosher audience that's naturally going to buy it, but what about beyond that? And because through the years, we've seen some amazing things happen with Susie, from her appearances on Good Morning America, The Today Show. She was written up in the New York Times, many different major city newspapers, the Los Angeles Daily News, the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Times, Miami Herald, many different papers that have picked up on her, plus many different magazines, both within and outside the Jewish world. So working with Susie has been the biggest project, single project that I've worked on that has a thread of continuity to it, because it's gone from book to book. There have been many different books that I've worked on individually with different authors, either from helping to create the talking points about that particular book, or helping to roll out some kind of publicity about it, anything from radio to other kinds of audio media, which I've been in media like yourself for many, many years, and I like to use it as a vehicle for consciousness raising, which is what we do on my show, the Gabrielle Sanders Show, that we now do on JWood Radio. We call it an hour of information, inspiration, motivation, and transformation.
Very good. I'll have to become an avid listener then.
I'll send you a link. So,
okay.
It's fun stuff. Well, look, there are a lot of people out there who are making a serious difference. And my experience, well, I'll just tell you and your listeners, I think, an important point. Somebody told me many years ago, it wasn't original to him, but he was one of my business and mentors of thinking. He's no longer with us. He died a few years ago, Gio Barella. And Gio, whose name in Italian means guide, Gio said to me one day, do you realize that in 5 years your income will be the average of your 5 closest friends? I had to think about that. The implications were very serious. If my income in 5 years would be the average of my 5 closest friends, maybe I needed some new friends. And the truth is, I did need new friends, and I did change my association. That was also around the time that I started my Jewish journey, interestingly enough, not for that reason, but in spite of that reason. And it's very interesting that within that 5-year window, my income went up 5 times because I did change my
association.
Wow, it did. Of course, we had the internet boom going on at the time, and I was involved with some technology projects and so forth. So it at one level, it, quote, looked easy. But on the other hand, it was true what Dio said. Now, that is also true of who a person becomes internally. If you want to change your inner landscape, then start hanging out with people who are gardens spiritually and not deserts. You know, so that's really, you read Pirkei Avot tells you very clearly, Aseh lecha rav uknei lecha chaver, make for yourself a rav, and Aseh lecha rav means two things. Make for yourself someone who's a spiritual guide to you, but it also, Aseh lecha, Rav, make yourself greater. And it says, "Upnei lecha chaver." Chaver is, it can mean a friend, or it can mean even purchase, connect